Now, so we're going to turn to our reading for today. So it's Matthew chapter 4, starting at verse 18, and going through to chapter 5, verse 16. And as you can see, it's on page 968 of the Church Bibles. Jesus calls his first disciples. As Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon, called Peter, and his brother Andrew. They were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. "Come, follow me," Jesus said, "and I will send you out to fish for people." At once they left their nets and followed him. Going on from there, he saw two brothers, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. They were in a boat with their father, Zebedee, preparing their nets. Jesus called them, and immediately they left the boat and their father and followed him. Jesus went throughout Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness among the people. News about him spread all over Syria, and people brought to him all who were ill with various diseases, those suffering severe pain, the demon-possessed, those having seizures, and the paralyzed, and he healed them. Large crowds from Galilee, the Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and the region across the Jordan followed him. Now when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. He said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything, except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." And Chris is going to come and share with us from that passage in a moment. Before he does so, we're going to, if the group wants to come up, we're going to sing another.
And thanks to Phil and the musicians and the guys at the back leading our worship this morning. If you've come expecting to hear Marcus preach, I'm afraid you're going to be disappointed. He was meant to be preaching, but he's got the lurgy, so he's under a duvet, feeling sad and sorry for himself. Before he succumbed to the lurgy, he had written part of this sermon. So this is a bit of a Anton Deck two-way effort. Some of this is me and some of this is Marcus. And I will let you work out which bits are which. As Phil has said, we're going to spend this term, and indeed quite a bit of the summer, looking through the Gospels at some of these amazing encounters that Jesus had. So if you're somebody especially who's not sure about their faith or new to the Christian faith or thinking about it, these are really ideal sermons to come and listen to, because they're all about different people meeting Jesus. Sick people, needy people who meet Jesus, loud, mouthy people, quiet and shy people who meet him, clever ones, desperate ones, powerful, hateful, worried, odd people. All of them meet Jesus, and the encounter they have with him changes their lives. And today we're starting with those fishermen who gave up everything and followed Jesus. But before that, let me take you back a few months to Christmas. And one of the most memorable Bible readings we have every year at Christmas in our carol service comes from that Old Testament prophecy in Isaiah 9. Facing the judgment of God for their sin and rebellion, the people needed to know if there was ever going to be any hope in the future for them, or whether God had forever set his face against them. And so Isaiah, prompted by the Holy Spirit, proclaims from God. And he proclaims, "The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in deep darkness, a light has dawned. For unto us a son is born, unto us a child is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulders. And he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace." And if you've got the passage that we read open in front of you, if you just go back up a few verses to chapter 4, verse 17, it says, "From that time on, Jesus began to preach, 'Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is near.' So the king has come, and he brings his kingdom with him." And so when Jesus comes down on the beach that morning, calling his disciples, it's with a very clear purpose and mission. That promised light that Isaiah spoke about has now dawned. Now Jesus is calling upon people to follow him. And I really like this very familiar story that we read about these two sets of brothers with their fishing boats. Simon and Andrew just finishing a night of fishing. If you read the equivalent passage in Mark, it talks about it being a very unproductive night they'd had. They're probably exhausted, they're dispirited. And then there's the other two brothers, James and John, nicknamed the Sons of Thunder because of their famous bad tempers. So they're probably pretty silent and grumpy. You cut the atmosphere with a knife, and there they are sorting out their nets with the hired men and with their dad. And here comes Jesus, walking down the beach that morning into their lives. Now, for many of us, at some point, Jesus walked down the beach into each of our lives, and we became Christians and followed him. So we know just how life-changing this was for them. Suddenly, the long-expected Messiah is here. The child, referred to in Isaiah chapter 9, is starting his world-changing mission. And in fulfillment of that prophetic word, he calls out a fresh generation of prophetic disciples. "Come, follow me, and I will send you to fish for people." And you know what? It really isn't who you would expect him to call. Certainly not for his core team, not the people around which he was going to build everything else. Because if you were God in the flesh, looking to put together your world-changing team, you probably wouldn't start with these guys. Foul-mouthed Peter, who engaged his mouth before he engaged his brain. James and John, who were on a short fuse and likely to go off at the first opportunity. But then probably Jesus wouldn't pick you or me. Jesus turns human expectations on their head. He calls the unlikely, the outcast, the rough, the underachievers, and says, I want you to follow me. Jesus will call traitors and theologians and freedom fighters and those involved in dodgy tax affairs and the young and the old and the rich and the poor. And he's called them into his great training program. You're not going to have your old fishing jobs anymore, he says. You're going to be with me now. And they weren't instantly transformed. Peter didn't instantly lose his foul mouth. But they knew that here was one they could commit their lives to. They left their old life in order to be with him and be involved in what he was doing. Sometimes when we tell our family and friends that we're Christians or the subject of our faith comes up, I think very often people have a very minimal view of what it means to be a Christian. They think we go to church services and pray and perhaps give some of our time and money. So the first question this morning is that the point of being a disciple? Well, to answer that, let's go back to that beach and Jesus speaking. Can you imagine Jesus coming to the fishermen and saying, follow me? And then replying, oh Jesus, okay, what you want us to do is you want us to come to the synagogue with you. You want us to go to more services. No, says Jesus, I'm saying, follow me and I will get you involved in fishing for people. Oh, said the fishermen, you want us to pray a bit more and give a bit more of our money. That's what you want. No, says Jesus, let's rewind. I seem to have lost you. I'm calling you to follow me, to be with me, to leave your old life behind and get in with me. Ah, said the fisherman, we understand you now. It's a metaphor, isn't it? You're asking us to invite you into our hearts for some kind of religious experience. That sounds good. Will there be singing? Will there be tambourines? We're fishermen. We love tambourines. Listen, says Jesus, which bit of this of follow me do you find difficult to understand? But that isn't what it means to be a disciple. Honestly, it's the they left everything thing that's quite unnerving, isn't it? Surely Jesus can't ask that level of commitment. Why do that? And for what future? Why would you leave your old life just because Jesus said so? Can't I just be a follower of Jesus and keep my head down? For example, just imagine that after coffee this morning, you're chatting with friends, and then I bound up and say, drop everything, come follow me. What would you think? Well, you'd be very polite and middle class about it, wouldn't you? But you'd be thinking, this now confirms our worst suspicions about Chris. He has finally lost it. We've known it's been coming, but now it's happened, his poor wife. But when Jesus says, come now, it's not a joke. And the fishermen don't think it's a joke. No, they really do drop everything and follow him immediately. And surely, above everything else, that shows Jesus' incredible authority over people. Notice that the passage says, at once, immediately, they left their nets and followed him. There's no umming or ahhing. They didn't ask to phone a friend or go away and think about it. They simply followed him. It must have been a very costly decision. That fishing business would have been worth a fair few quid. All that hard work, all that experience left behind. But no, Jesus comes first. At once, they follow him. So what's this teaching us? Well, we're not being taught that when you become a Christian, you must suspend all rational thought and blindly follow Jesus. He's not saying that at all, I think. Elsewhere, Jesus urges us to think carefully and consider the cost of following him. That's one of the reasons why at this church we lay on alpha courses, which help us think through what it means to follow Jesus. And it's vital, if we're not a Christian, to do that, to think through carefully his claims on our life. God has given each one of us a mind to think with, and becoming a Christian involves the mind just as much as anything else. But at the end of the day, we have to face the awesome authority of Jesus Christ. Because Jesus didn't say, "Excuse me, fishermen. Excuse me, James and John. Sorry to bother you. You appear to be a bit tied up. Would you mind awfully, if you've got nothing better to do, coming along with me today?" Jesus isn't inviting us to join his gang or go along to a tea party. He's commanding us as Lord of the universe to follow him. And either we obey him in that command or we don't. Those are the only two options. As God in the flesh, this Jesus stands before us and commands us to follow him. He's asking for the keys to our life, for him to take rightful control, for he is our king, whether we admit that or not. And to have this loving, powerful king as our Lord is the best way to live, because that is what we were made for. So what will it mean to obey Jesus' command in practice? Well, these four men that morning had to submit to Jesus' authority in two areas. Firstly, they had to realise that nothing else comes before Jesus. That's quite a broad statement, but I think that's the point. Because we cannot restrict Jesus Christ to being Lord over a bit of our lives. If you were here a few weeks ago, I preached on that verse from Acts chapter 2, verse 36. "Therefore God has made this Jesus whom you crucified both Lord and Christ." You see, those fishermen dropped everything for Jesus. They knew he was their saviour, but he knew he was also the Lord of their lives. They unashamedly allowed him to have total control. And for them it meant leaving their work behind. It says that they simply left their nets. It's a very powerful picture, isn't it, of saying goodbye to the old way of doing things with us as the boss of our lives. Now that doesn't mean, I don't think, doesn't mean that we have to give up necessarily our jobs when we become Christians. Unless you're an international criminal mastermind or a hitman, probably not a good idea to continue doing that. But broadly speaking, you can carry on doing your job, I think, when you become a Christian. But the point is that Jesus is to come first before everything else, even work. Because following Jesus is an all-encompassing commitment. It would involve how we act as a parent, as an employee, as an employer. It will affect how we drive on the roads and how we fill in our tax form. It will affect our lifestyle choices. It will affect the way we choose our holidays, what we spend our money on, and how we use our time. Now we might say, well, how? How does that all work in practice? Well, following Jesus as Lord will work itself out in different ways, in different situations. But perhaps the best question to ask ourselves is it obvious to an onlooker from the way I conduct myself in every area of my life? Is it obvious to that onlooker that I follow another king, King Jesus? Is it clear in every area of life that Jesus and his standards and his desires take first priority? So often we want to compartmentalise Jesus, put him in a box and say, okay, Jesus, I'll follow you Sundays and Wednesday afternoons and every other Thursday. But let me be Lord the rest of the time. No, we might not think it or rationalise it like that, but I suspect for many of us that is the reality. James Hudson Taylor was one of the great missionaries to China in the 19th and early 20th century. And he said, Jesus must be Lord of all or not at all. Jesus must be Lord of all or not at all. Nothing else before Jesus. But there's another thing that those men learnt that morning about Jesus' authority, and that is that no one else comes before Jesus. Did you notice the three very powerful words in verse 22? Jesus called them, and immediately they left their boat and their father and followed him. It's very powerful, isn't it? They even left their father standing on the seashore. Now, I have to admit, whenever I've read this passage previously, I've always read it from the passage from the point of view of James and John. They gathered up, they left their nets, and they went and followed Jesus. It is a sign of my age and decrepitude that when I was preparing this week, it suddenly struck me about the Father. That he's standing there. One minute he's standing there with his sons, and they're just doing what they've done 100 times, sorting out after their fishing expeditions. This guy rolls up, 10 minutes later, they've left him. That's a difficult conversation to go back and have with the wife, isn't it? That's really difficult. But nothing can come in the way of our relationship with Jesus. Not even the closest family ties that we know in this world. And for many of us, that's really tough. And I appreciate it's a real stumbling block for many people. I remember a close friend of mine who'd heard the gospel many times and was really close to trusting Jesus. And I asked him once what was stopping him. And he said, very honestly, I'm afraid of what my dad will think. Jesus demands total allegiance. And for some of us, that will be very costly. We can all think of people who've had very painful times when they've had to say to their families that Jesus comes first. For some, it's been very costly in terms of our relationship with our spouse, with our parents, with our children. And if we've been willing to pay that price, then we need to remember Jesus' words, that no one who has left home or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or fields for me and the gospel will fail to receive 100 times as much in the present age and in the age to come. Jesus recognises our cost and he will provide for us both now and in the future. But the challenge still remains, doesn't it? And for some of us, we need to hear that challenge, that Jesus comes before our family. And that sometimes means taking hard decisions because of our allegiance to Christ. Might mean a tough time for a Christian student returning to a non-Christian family. Our parents might resent the fact that we go to church. But ultimately, Jesus comes first. Now, he's not saying, of course he's not saying, we need to ignore our friends and family. He's saying that he comes first, even before our nearest and dearest. Because that's what it means to follow him. But having called his disciples, Jesus knows he needs to ensure that they know what they've signed up for. For they are to be promoters of the values of the new kingdom that Jesus is bringing in. They need to change within. And so there are two passages that we read about the teachings of Jesus, the teachers of the new kingdom. His first instruction to them is the Beatitudes, and we'll come back to those in a minute. But in verses 13 to 16, he says that his disciples, his followers, are meant to let our light shine in order that people see the deeds and glorify God. We are living for the glory of God. And we can't disguise that. Jesus says to us, you are the light of the world. And it's very easy, isn't it, to be tempted to think, but I'd rather not be. Can't I be a hidden light so that only those under the bulb can see me? Well, Jesus says that isn't the point of lights. You put lights on a stand and everyone sees it. And he says, you're the salt of the earth, living so God's grace is praised. The thing about salt is it's unmissable, it's undisguisable. A chip without salt is a chip not worth eating. You know salt is there. You taste the difference it makes. It's nonsense to say, can't I be unsalty salt? I want to be salt, but just not the salt that anyone notices. It's crazy, isn't it? Jesus says, if salt loses its saltiness, that it isn't good for anything. If disciples are not salty, or are no longer shining, then they aren't living as disciples. And there are echoes here, aren't there, of that passage from Isaiah 9 again. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. Jesus is that great light. And anyone who comes to him gets to be a little light. We get ignited by him, if you like. We don't say to the king, I'd like to come to you, but I don't want to shine for you. No, the light has dawned, and those who follow the light are lights as well. And so the disciples followed. They followed. And they followed, it says, throughout Galilee, as Jesus preached and proclaimed the good news of his kingdom, as he healed diseases, cast out demons, dealt with paralysis and seizures. And there were large crowds, and they came from Syria, that stretched a long way to the north, far beyond the borders of Israel, and Jerusalem, which is a long way south, the Decapolis, the 10 towns, and the areas east of Jordan. Huge areas they covered. And there are crowds, and the danger of the crowds is that sometimes crowds gather for what they can get. Jesus has compassion on those in the crowds. But it doesn't mean that those in the crowd wanted to be disciples. Some of them just liked being around Jesus and his disciples. There was great stuff going on and they wanted to see it. The disciples were different. They followed because Jesus called them. The crowds followed because of the healings. And sometimes we can be crowds or we can be a disciple. We can be people who are following Jesus or we can be people who are just on the edge, mildly interesting, watching other people. And of course what happens a bit later in the story is that a few weeks later the crowds will all disappear when Jesus tells them that they have to come on his terms as well. After feeding the 5,000, Jesus effectively says, are you here because you got fed lunch? Or are you here because you want to be a real follower? And when he gives them that challenge, the crowd disappears from thousands to half a dozen in about 10 minutes. The crowds hadn't submitted to him as king. I run my own life, they think. I thought we followed Jesus for what we got, not because we had to change. But let's go back to the Beatitudes, which is the first thing Jesus teaches his disciples. This is the first kingdom teaching that those disciples get. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the humble, in other words. These sayings are all about what we believe, about our character before God, about hungering and thirsting for the gift of righteousness from God. There's lots of repetition. The first and the last. Blessed are those who are poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs also is the kingdom of heaven. The first four sayings are basically, this is what a disciple heart looks like. And the second four are, here is what disciples do. They show mercy. They show purity. They are peacemakers. Oh, and by the way, says Jesus, as he brings that bit to an end, by the way, you'll be persecuted for doing all of this. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness. Now, verses 11 and 12 say what happens when we live for Jesus. People insult us, persecute us, and falsely say evil against us. And Jesus says that's because of him. They insulted him, they persecuted him, they falsely said evil about him. And they will say it about us too. If not here, then somewhere else. If not today, then in the future. And that sounds awful, doesn't it? But what does Jesus say? It is a cause for great joy. Rejoice, he says, because your reward is great in heaven. Your hope is greater by far than all your troubles. And he also says, remember they persecuted the previous prophets in the same way. Now that's an amazing statement. Those prophets, those great messengers of God from the past. They are in our line. They testified to the coming Christ. And he says to us as disciples, you are in that prophetic line too. In fact, we testify more clearly to him than they did, because we have the reality of Jesus and they only had the promise. So Jesus reminds us that being a disciple is a prophetic ministry. So the community of Gospels right here, right now at Crofton is a prophetic community declaring the glory of God to the world. So here is Jesus, first calling and then training. Come follow me and... how do we end that sentence? Come follow me and everything will remain exactly the same and unchanged. Come follow me and your life will be always fulfilling and comfortable. Come follow me and, well, if we add our own, then that's not Jesus. That's vending machine Jesus, isn't it? We put our money in, we work out what we want, and we press the button and pull it out. I put my money in, I get a religious service, God exists for me. I will add Jesus into my life, but essentially carry on living for me. Jesus says no. I'm cutting it completely across that. Come out. Reorient your life. You used to be your own master, or you thought you were. Now you are a follower. Jesus is the boss. And as we finish, let's go back. Let's go back to that beach that morning. And run forward a bit through the years. All of those disciples called that morning by Jesus lived lives of incredible Christian service and ministry. Those fishermen were used mightily by God. Countless people were brought into God's kingdom, were healed, and saw the power of God in action. Those men were sent thousands of miles across the ancient world to share the gospel of Christ. And all of them were martyred for their faith. They gave their lives in service of the Jesus who called them and equipped them. That Jesus who said that morning by the lake, come follow me. An invitation he calls out loud and clear to us today.